Well, it's just so many things. It's like I can't keep up anymore. So it becomes overwhelming.
That was a yawn, but it was a Christian yawn.
What's the difference?
What's the difference?
He's a Christian.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, dear Father, we just invite you here again, as you we know that you are here because you said whenever two or more are gathered, you are there in our midst, Lord. But we also personally invite you to open our ears and open our eyes to see what you have for us, especially in biblical counseling. We ask it in Jesus' name. They're
God
building picture frames next door.
Oh.
So,
God's knocking on our head.
Yeah, it's like, you know, if that's the writing on the wall. What can I say? Okay, so we had Tony in last week, and I invited him. I'll have another video for you this coming week, coming up, where I do the U-turn for Christ. So he'll be making his presentation at school, and then we'll see it on the video. I can't ask him to come out twice. I do it every other. They come here or they come there. U-turn for Christ is a residential out in Lake Elsinore area for recovering addictions. Okay, and but I had Tony come first because I wanted to point out in Ed Welch's book. Ed Welch does a lot of little guides that you see right there. I have those are not Ed Welch's, but the one is what it says, just one more. So they have the little handout books that. But he wrote a really good book on addictions, Banquet for the Grave, Ed Welch. Okay, so not that you're going to add to your library, but you have it on the bibliography. But that's where I get my notes from. Okay, and when it comes to addictions. Your book that you guys have, the one that talks about the psychological terms and then the Christian terms, in that you had 8 or 9 different types of addictions that people can have. But there's something that is the same that happens with all addictions. So we started with Tony, and you didn't really realize his addiction until 10 minutes into his presentation that he mentioned pornography. At first, if you were just listening, you would have thought he was going to say, well, he was addicted to alcohol, or he was addicted. Because they even used the word, once I became sober. And sober, for everybody, is that point when you realize, this is no longer going to be what I do in my life. I'm done with that. And then you conquer it. And in the world of addictions, the recidivism rate is over 7. So people beat the addiction, then they go back to the addiction. They beat the addiction, they go back to the addiction. It's like, it takes like 7 times before they finally are recovered. And then there are programs, and I went over them in the class last time, like Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. But their recovery rate in those things is in the 50% range. And so it's like, half a dozen of one, half a dozen of the other, so what are you going to do? The recidivism rate in U-turn from Christ is 0 because they're changed people from the heart. They've given their lives to Christ. Now, I'm sure there is people that have backslidden. I haven't asked them to give me data, but the person that turns their life over to Christ and truly means it and lives it, God gives them the power to control the addiction. The addiction no longer becomes their God. The thing that's the same in all addictions is the phrase, just one more. I'll feel better with just one more. And so everybody has to be retaught how to think, because it doesn't work. When you're dependent on something, you're a slave to it. You don't have a choice. So what is the difference then between an idol? Idols are deaf, dumb, and blind. They're utterly senseless and irrational. those that make them will be like them, and so all who trust in them. That's Psalm 115, verse 8. Psalm 115, verse 8. In other words, idols don't cooperate. Rather than mastering our idols, we become enslaved by them and begin to look like them, literally, okay? Idols are deaf and dumb and blind, utterly senseless and irrational. And then in Psalm 115:8 it says, and those who make them will be like them, and so with all who trust in them. So God's word reminds us in Ephesians 6:12 that our battle is not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers in high places. Therefore, God's word reminds us, for our struggle is not against flesh and blood or alcohol or drugs, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. So, it applies to every human being. We set our affections on ourselves, and we choose idols that we will hope satisfy us. And then that will help, that that gets us to a point where we start avoiding the worship of the one true God. Okay? But what about the different types of addictions? Can't we make some distinctions between a person addicted to alcohol and one addicted to work? Okay? Should we stress the unity in all addictions? So what is the difference between idols that are satisfied by a big paycheck, respect of colleagues, or the adoring love of a spouse, and the idols that are satisfied by mind-altering or physical sensations? The answer is an important one. Some idols hook our bodies, passions, and desires. This group of addictions includes drugs, legal and illegal. Drugs, legal and illegal, because we live in a day and age now where recreational marijuana is a legal drug. So you can guess that in the next 15 years, the amount of people using marijuana is going to quadruple because it's now legal. Okay? So sexual sin and alcohol and food all fall under those realms. They're physical pleasure. They relieve physical tension. They soothe physical desire. Okay? So Satan enters the drama because he has a special interest in exploiting the body's natural needs and desires. If someone feels physically good, you can bet he will try to take advantage of it. I've never had what the athletes call when you run a race and you get the endorphins, or, you know, I always feel terrible when I run. So I'm sure that there comes a point, but I have felt really good upon completion of a task that I worked really hard at, and the endorphins are flooding my body. And I go, I'm good. I feel like that project is done. I feel good about that. So Satan wants to overturn God's order and have physical desires rule the person, because what are we made up of? We're made up of a body. Our body and mind are one thing. That we call that the physical. Then we have a conscience where our personality and our good versus evil dwells, right? And then we have a spirit side of us where God is dwelling in us and interfacing with us. So, you know, instead of food, sex, or rest being treated as God-given pleasures, they are exalted to becoming ruling lusts that enslave us. So when you talk about addictions, I could take out a book right now and I could say, let's talk about bulimia. Let's talk about anorexia. Those are addictions. Let's talk about people that overwork. That's an addiction. So they all have the same thing in mind, that they become an idol. And then Satan moves right in and uses the part of our body that Paul in Romans chapter 5, 6, and 7, and 8, said we war against the physical. And he says, I beat my body to keep it into submission. What he was really saying was, I reckon myself dead to sin. I don't have to sin, and if I do, it's a choice. Because at the cross, Jesus took away all of that. Now, I have never met a perfect Christian that doesn't sin anymore, because we just don't ever beat that body up enough. It just seems to win. So you can group all of them under the title of idolatry. And you treat then every addiction basically the same way. Treat the physical, then treat the spiritual. So in that regard, there really isn't a big difference between a physical addiction and an addiction that is one of just plain, you know, like a guy that works 100 hours a week and never sees his family is addicted to his job. They're both idols, and they both need to be dealt with physically, and they both need to be dealt with, as your book talked about, dehabituation and rehabituation, which is the put off and put on that we learned last semester. You put off those things that are ungodly, put on the things that are godly. Okay? So, Paul says, I do not fight like a man beating the air. No, I beat my body and make it my slave. My slave. So, basically, if you have a heart, and it has a heart that desires just one more, then the body is satisfied, then it goes back in that vicious circle. It has to be satisfied again and again and again. It never changes. So, we want to be careful. So, have you ever tried to go on a diet?
Yes.
Okay. Then, how hard was it to stay to the diet? How long was it? And did you go back? I love my wife, because she's always talking about the fact that she's a lifetime member of Jenny Craig. I know. That's the epitome of being a slave to being on a diet. It's like, you've never trained the body to be anything different. It's just, it's short term. It's a short term goal, short term realization, and then you go back to eating a Twinkie again. So, you know, it's crazy. So, for the addict, dope then is the god. For the addict, alcohol is the drug. For the addict, sex becomes the drug. Okay? And then you talked about what Tony talked about. You end up feeling guilty, you try it again, then again, and that's the substance abuse syndrome right in front of you. What people suffer on a diet is what somebody on drugs is going through, or any other idolatry that they're going through, okay? So, you know, the bottom line is we need to be careful about acting like there's only one kind of drug. The other thing, or one kind of addiction, the other thing is once you go into idolatry, which is putting that as your god, what also happens? You end up committing adultery, because who are you really married to? Jesus Christ. So both things come into play, and that's what Tony talked about. Tony fought addiction for 20... When he told me that he had fought that for 25 years... You know, I was sitting over here and I heard him say that, and I've heard him before, but it hit me differently this time, because I was thinking, how many people go to church? And then I was thinking about how many men I know do pornography. And then I was doing the numbers in my head, just thinking, okay, so on any given Sunday, 5,000 people show up to church, and 60% are doing pornography. You do the math, that's 3,000 people. You know, no one wants to say that out loud, because that, you know, but church is, I said it before, church really needs to be spiritual hospital zone. It's out there, and it's prevalent among us, and in the Christian church, it's kind of like, the thing about addictions that's hard to deal with from the church perspective is we become holier than thou, and we look down on people that haven't met our expectations of what, you know, the Christian should look like. And we don't realize that there we go, but by the grace of God. So we need to have a real openness toward people that are suffering and be willing to say to them, look, if God loves you, God wants to help you, we're going to help you, we're going to be there for you, and we don't look down at them because of it, you know. It's one thing to see a guy in Skid Row that can barely walk and he's drunk, and you go down and you have a dinner downtown and you go, oh, how sad. I hope the Lord can do something for that fellow, you know, and you hope somebody will go there and, you know people are down there ministering and stuff, so you lift them up and you maybe even support somebody like that, or maybe you even go once a month down there, you know, but how would you be affected if that person was in the third pew, barely able to stumble down the aisle and happened to come into church? You know, what are we going to do then? You know, we got to be ready to help those people. So you have the physical addiction, and then you have what I call the addiction of, it's not physical, but it's like you go to work, you become a workaholic, you become OCD, all those things are also addictions. So you have that comparison of the two. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay? So it's important for us when we are dealing with people that are in an addiction, in an addictive state, that we don't excuse it. We don't call drinking, oh, you have an alcohol problem. We call it what it is, drunkenness. We call it what it is. And we don't encourage the self-deceptive consequences of sin. Number two, we need to help them confess it as sin against a living God. What did David say when he was caught in adultery with Bathsheba? He didn't blame Bathsheba. He didn't blame the naked practice of the practice of naked people bathing on the roof. He didn't say, "Well, guy, I'm just this virile guy, and man, I'm 27 years old, and I'm the king, and I just have to have lots of sex, man. It's the way God made me. It's my phusis." And we did phusis last week. That word, phusis. I went over that in your book. Hey, I can't help it, so I am. We don't excuse it. We say, we confess it like David did. Against you and only you have I done this evil in your sight. So we confess it. All right? And then we have to look to Jesus. Number three, we look to Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith. Hebrews 12. He's the author and the finisher of faith. Philippians 1:6, he who has begun a good work in you will complete it till the day of Jesus Christ. God's working in your life. Yes, you're in this state now. You don't have to be here forever. The faster you commit to Jesus, the faster you commit your life to him, the faster you seek forgiveness and do a 180-degree turn, the faster your recovery will be. Now, you turn for Christ, you'll see it next week. They don't go in, they're not. Those people aren't changed in 6 weeks or 8 weeks. Now, there are miracles, I talked about last week. There are miracles where people get healed instantaneously. Okay? And they never have a cigarette another day in their life. Never do marijuana again. Never do drugs again. Those are rare and far in between the reality. Most people are going to struggle with addiction for a long, long time. Even when they're in the state of recovery, and they've won over it. Tony will tell you that he can't be anywhere around pornography. He has to guard, and he's made a covenant with his eyes, his wife, his family, and he has accountability partners, right? When I go do my ATM business, there used to be an ATM shop, a liquor store, that used to be on Main Avenue in Chula Vista. The ATM sat right here. Right to the left of the ATM machine are all the X-rated books in the entire store. So here I am, right? I come in, do the ATM. If I even look to my left, even nonchalantly, you know, I have the titles because they're all in little plastic covers because the law says you can't let kids see them. But they have titles that are very provocative, you know? And so you're reading a title, well, that causes your brain to start thinking about, well, what does it mean, Debbie's in Dallas? You're going, what are we doing in Dallas? And then your brain starts racing, you start doing self-talk, then you get the memories, because your brain, I like to say it this way, God doesn't provide a giant eraser that erases your past in your brain. You still remember when you did stupid things. It's meant to be there so that you can go back and say, wow, look how far I've come. I don't want to go back there again. That's a good way to look at the past. Past can be good if you're looking at it that way. What I taught last semester was, forget the past. What can you do about it? It is in the past. Like Rafiki told Simba, what does it matter? It is in the past. Well, past is good if we use it correctly to tell us where God has taken us. We look at the slum we were in, look at where we're at now. So in that way, using the past is good. But to wallow in the past, oh, woe is me. Now you're slapping the hand that forgave you. Because forgiveness is forever. And we'll go on the forgiveness in a minute. So the fourth thing, you start growing in faith. So after you've looked at Jesus, the one who's shown you grace and mercy, then you grow in faith by knowing God. And so you start replacing your thought process with biblical truth. And so you start learning what it says about idolatry, what it says about adultery. What's the main thing we teach in biblical counseling? We don't go by our feelings. Our feelings are going to lie to us. We go by what God's truth says. Period. The next thing is, we learn to delight in obedience to Him. And we find ways to obey in Scripture. The next one is, don't rely on yourself by yourself. Always have an accountability partner. I can't tell you how many people I've counseled that didn't want an accountability partner, and it caused them to have relapse after relapse because there's nobody to check up on them. You know, it's easy to do stuff in the secret of night. You ever notice when you go, have you ever been to, because I work in the industry that I work in, I see this all the time. When someone goes buys a beer at a liquor store, what does the attendant do for them? They go buy a can of beer. Yeah, I go buy a Coke, and I walk out the door with my Coke, right? What does the attendant at a liquor store do to the person that buys a Bud, a 24-ounce can of beer, or a Coors? What do they do? They put it in a paper bag. So they can walk out with it, because you can't have it public. It's got to be in a paper bag. People are always hiding it. Okay? Whenever you go to a bar, you'll never go to a bar that's all lit up with bright lights. It's always dark. You go to Vegas, it's dark in the casino. It's well lit in terms of all the gambling, the sparkly lights. But it's dim light when you're over on the machine. The machine is, the light on you is dim. And so what you want to make sure you do is that you don't want to hook up. You want to change the environment, okay? And then pursue wisdom. How do you pursue wisdom? Again, you get into the Scriptures. Because Jesus said it best. The truth shall set you free. You're no longer a slave to sin, Paul said. 2 Corinthians 5:17. Behold, all things are new. The old has passed away. You're a new creature in Christ. You're not the same. And I like that because that means ongoing. I mean, you're changed as a Christian right now, the minute you gave your heart to Jesus. But seriously, if I asked you right now, are you the same Christian you were the first day you gave yourself to the Lord? No. Well, what's happened? You've grown. Have you had setbacks? Yes. Have you had moments when you did lose your temper, even though you shouldn't have?
Sometimes.
Yeah, and then you've learned. Okay, and then you learn the hard way that God, and then God shapes you and forms you. You're not the same you were. If I'm the same person I was when I recommitted my life in 1981, then I haven't grown. I mean, you know, there's huge areas where I've grown. There's huge areas where I still need to grow. And God is real good about opening those doors and saying, have you gotten... I like that when you say, Lord, come into my heart, go into my closet, see what's there. I'm locking every door for you to go in. Clean up what you got to go in. And then you hear this little voice in the back of your head, well, I'm going to door number 7. You sure I want to go in there? No, Lord, can you go to door 8? Door 7 is... Still, don't go in there. The next thing you know, he's in there, and then you're going, oh my gosh, I got to deal with that now. I don't know about you guys, but I try to do, I do David Jeremiah's little blurbs, and I do Our Daily Bread and a couple other things, just for, especially when I'm waiting in a bank line or something. It's like, and it never fails when I do one of those morning devotion things where it asks this question, it'll go, how are you dealing with people today? You know, and then it'll go on. It'll be a verse about dealing, loving your neighbor as yourself. And of course, I just got off the freeway, so it's like, you know, darn, you know. And then, so the Lord is constantly renewing us. Romans 12. We're to be renewed, and it's not a one-time thing. It's every single day. It's every single hour of that day. In fact, if you really want to read the verse correctly, it's like, be renewed every minute of the moment of the 24-hour day. That's what it means to be renewed. That means from the time you hit the office at church till the time you go home from the office, hey, godly people don't always do and say godly things. They just don't. It would be nice if they did, but they don't. And you have to like be patient and work with people, and all of it, all that goes together. Does that make sense? Okay. The next one is, and then realize that addiction, like all sin, doesn't impose itself on us unless we open the door. So what do I mean by that? If I went to a desert island, right, and I'm the only person there, I'm not going to become an alcoholic. Why? I'm not going to be able to create alcohol very well. I might eventually learn how to ferment pineapple juice, you know, but the chance of me becoming a speed addict is pretty slim, right? I'm not going to be a methamphetamine addict. It's not going to be on the island. You know, addictions are the only, according to the world, what are addictions labeled under? They're labeled under disease. Right? Because they use the medical model. So they've labeled it a disease. Well, addictions are the only diseases that you can't catch. You have to invite them. I can catch the flu. I can catch pneumonia. I can catch polio. I can catch a staph infection. Right? But I can't catch being an alcoholic. I can't catch being a porno addict. I can't catch... being a methamphetamine. I can't catch being an addicted person to Prozac. Those things I had to open the door and readily invite them in and practice them over time to give them the power over my life. Does that make sense? So that's the big thing about addiction. So one of the questions that I got asked between the break was, what about, because Tony didn't talk about it, so let me just do a few things on it, but I'll do it later in the class. Remind me when I get to change, and we'll talk about it again. But what about all the family members that are involved in someone's addiction? See, addiction doesn't just affect the one person. For Tony, it affected his wife and his family and his kids. Okay? And my family, my daughter, I don't think even knows to this day that I had that issue. It's something I've chosen not to discuss with her. You know, if she ever listens to one of these tapes, then I'll probably have to do a lot of explaining. Because, you know, dad will go down immeasurably in status. But, you know, the bottom line is that we have to be open to the fact that our problem, our sin, then cause problems for everybody around us. And vice versa. If your kids become addicted to drugs, it will affect you, the parent. You'll be beating your head against the wall. Like, where did I go wrong? And so the big thing that comes into play always is forgiveness. So let me go to that for a minute here so I can do a video. Before I do that, I'm taking a few seconds because I want to talk about the difference between the counseling guides you did last semester and what you do this semester. Counseling guides last semester were pretty simplistic. I asked you to do a scenario, do you remember? Or a biblical scenario. And then you did, what does the Bible say about that? And then you did some Bible statements. These are verses I would use in my counseling. And then you walked them through how to counsel. And it was pretty surface level. You used one of the little books that I handed out or anything like that. Okay, so I gave these guys to you. This comes from self-confrontation from BCF, okay? So the first one is Bible study and application format. And remember I told you that how do we get change in anybody? I gave you that handout. How do you bring about change in anybody? It's 2 Timothy 3:16 through 17. God's word is for reproof, for correction, so that the man of God will be thoroughly equipped. So that's the basis, okay? Then, so here, last week you were talking about addictions. So this is what you would use if you wanted to do a quick study guide, counseling guide on an addiction. The biblical reference would be in the first column. So you could pick out, what does Proverbs say about being drunk? What does the Bible say about it? What does Paul say? He associates you with a dispensation. So teaching, what's the commandment or principle? And then reproof. Okay, how have I failed to live by it? Notice those four words on top are the same words used in Corinthians 3:16 through 17. Teaching, reproof, correction, and then training in righteousness. So in the teaching part, what's the commandment or principle? And then for reproof, how have I failed to live by it? Correction, what do I need to do? And training in righteousness, what is my specific plan? How will I do it? Okay, now, above the words reproof and teaching, I want you to write the word concern. So on that top line, just write the word concern. Because if you have a love for somebody, you're going to have a deep, honest concern for them, right? And that concern will lead to reproving and teaching them, all right? Now, underneath reproof in that same box, how I failed to live up to it, put in the word confrontation. Because last semester we learned that the word nouthetic, which comes from Romans 15:14, is the Greek word noutheo, which means to have a concern for the person, a willingness to confront them about it, and then a willingness to walk them through on how to change. So over in correction and training in righteousness, on the top line up there, above those two, you're going to write, because your book talked about a new word for put off, put on. It talked about what? Rehabituation. And dehabituation, which is a fancy way of saying put off, put on. And that, of course, comes from Ephesians 4 and Colossians 3.
So dehabituation is put off?
Dehabituation is put off, and rehabituation is put on. And those two words were in your reading in your advanced counseling book. Okay? It's a little more detailed now than it was last semester. So you see on this first page, that's a lot more meat than was in your counseling guide last time. You would slide this whole thing in on what you would counsel. Okay? Now, go to the next page. Are we clear on that? Are we okay? All right? You don't have to write everything, by the way. Somebody asked me two semesters ago, how am I going to fit everything in these little teeny columns? And my response to that student was, because you're going to have to write really tiny. And then I'm going to have to get a really big magnifying glass. You're not going to do it in the columns. This is just a note-taking device. You're still going to write a counseling guide with these subtitles as maybe sections of a counseling guide. But suddenly, if you use this, your counseling guide has gone from a page and a half to 5 pages. You know what I'm saying? I'm not saying all your counseling guides have to be 6 pages long. I'm saying like the first one on addiction, it should be about 4 pages because you're going to really use this, okay? Now, when you are counseling somebody, then we have page 2 because it'll happen automatically. I hate to say this, but look at the third word at the top of that page. What is it?
Failures.
Well, I hate to announce to you, but when you counsel somebody, get ready for failures. Okay? Just like you saw Trey and Deb the first time he came back, Trey didn't have his homework done. You're going to be dealing with somebody, especially when it comes to addictions. You better know something right up front. An addictive person is a blatant liar. So forget whatever personality they have, all those things we talked about, I don't care. The first thing you're going to know about anybody who's addicted is that you need to look at them and you need to see on their forehead, liar, liar, pants on fire. Doesn't matter what they say, you take it with a grain of salt. Yeah, I've had a really great week. Back of your mind, you're going, you're such a liar. What happened on Tuesday? You're gonna do the confrontation right away. So tell me about your week. How was your Monday morning after Sunday? Okay, Saturday you were drug-free and sober. You didn't have a drink? No. Sunday you went to church. You had what was the topic of the sermon? Really great. Did you get anything out of it? Yeah, great. Great. What did you do Sunday afternoon? Oh, I just laid around the house. Really? And a week ago you were really drinking alcohol to an extent where your wife made you come to counseling. So you're just going to sit there and tell me you did not sneak a beer on Sunday afternoon. Well, you know, I don't like, okay, you got me. I had one. I go, and then right away, what am I going to say? Liar, liar, pants on fire. You didn't have one, you had two, maybe three. You know, and I'm doing it out of love. I'll use comedy with him and stuff. And then, well, what happened Monday? How was Monday morning when you got up? Didn't feel good, did you? Oh, no, I didn't really. What'd you take? Well, I took a bunch of Advil, and then I drank a bunch of this other stuff that makes you peppy. And so, you know, you got the guy that's taking methamphetamines from the counter that his wife had. And so it's just this never-ending battle, okay? So you're going to have failures. So look at this chart. So, number one, right away help them by, and if you have the other chart out, keep it out because, number one, my specific on biblical thoughts, words, and actions. Notice three areas. I'm on this chart. The failure chart. Okay, yeah. So underline those three words. Thoughts, words, actions. Because it can be any of the three where the person failed. Okay? Now, that would be tied into correction on the first sheet. How are you correcting it? Right? And then training in righteousness. Because look at the next two boxes. Put off and the biblical references. Put on biblical references. So for us, let's say, for example, I'm talking to somebody who's not an alcoholic, but they are an excessive drinker. An alcoholic would be defined as someone that They literally are having X amount of drinks a day. They can't function without it. Okay, this person is a church-going person, and they just drink too much. And so they're getting drunk on a couple of days a week. They haven't gone to the point where it's costing them their job or their family. So we're not talking about an alcoholic syndrome yet. We're getting close, but we're not there. But we want to get that person to start not doing drinking to that extent. And so we'll talk about their unbiblical thoughts and words and actions. What do you think about drinking? Let's look at it from a biblical perspective. This is what God says about drinking. And I always tell them, always, there is nowhere in the Bible where it says, thou shalt not drink. Everybody thinks that. The Baptist made that real clear. The Baptist had him no drinking and no dancing. It doesn't say that. David danced naked in the gates of Jerusalem. David danced. David drank. The Proverbs even says, God in Psalms always even says, wine is a joy to the spirit. So is God saying abstinence completely from drinking? Or is he saying, like Paul to Timothy, take a little wine for your stomach? See, I think there's a balance. Now, as a Christian, I like what Greg Laurie says. Why do I want to put something in my system that I know can do me harm? You know, I might be someone that doesn't drink at all, and I have two drinks, and I get in a car, and I have a DUI. If I wouldn't have drank, I wouldn't have had a DUI. So if you don't have to, don't. It's better if you can say, stay abstinent from it. You know, there are other people that are going to say, I like wine with my dinner. And healthy-wise, the medical profession says having a glass of wine at dinner time is good for your heart. So there's everybody has to weigh what the balance is. Does that make sense? Okay? As a pastor in Calvary Chapel, they've asked all of us not to drink. Because how do I know I'm not going to get called out at 8 o'clock at night to go service somebody's been in a horrible accident and I've had a beer or I've had wine on my breath? You know, that's not going to go over real well. So that's kind of what we do. Okay.
All the places where it says wine, does it mean alcoholic in the Bible?
Yeah, usually. Yeah, there's a real controversy about that. Did Jesus really make alcoholic wine? Yeah.
So I was just thinking about to calm your stomach. Maybe it was some sort of apple cider vinegar or something. Because wine would not calm my stomach.
In those days, they had to ferment things in order for it to keep. Fermenting means it has an alcoholic content. Does it have the same alcoholic content as the drinks that we have today? No. But please notice that at Cana, everybody was drinking heavily. And the guy said, you've saved the best wine for last. Because if Jesus creates wine, it's going to be the greatest wine of all time. Okay? And we see drunkenness all the way through the Bible. When Noah got drunk, his children saw him naked. All this alcohol, when they say, John MacArthur has a big article about it where he says that the alcohol wasn't, when they had Passover and stuff, that it wasn't an alcoholic drink, it was just grape juice. And he makes a big deal about it. And I'm going, I'm sorry, I love you, John, but I'm just not going there because it was all alcoholic. It was enough for Nero to get drunk. It was enough for the kings to get drunk. You know, now how much did they have to drink? They probably had to drink a lot to get drunk, but it still made them drunk. So my take on it, my personal opinion, from what I've read and studied, yeah, it's alcoholic. It's the same alcoholic that they produce today in a can of beer? No, because they have modern science doing everything now. They're just pounding the alcoholic content. So. Right, back to our thing. And then the last one. My plan not to repeat this sin and to respond biblically instead, I would put the words in there, actions versus feelings. Actions versus feelings. Why do I say that? Because how you feel doesn't matter. It's the action you take. God didn't say, forgive your brother for that sin, but remember it. He said, forget it, forgive him, and forget it. In other words, the action is, I'm going to forget it. I'm going to take God as his word, and I'm I'm not going to deal with it anymore. Does that make sense? So those two sheets go together, okay? Okay, third sheet real quick. Look what this is. It's a biblical counseling record. This would be what you would actually do as a counselor if you're seeing somebody. Now, if you're seeing somebody as a non-professional counselor or as a non-biblical counselor, and it's just somebody you're dealing with at church, you can still use these forms because they're going to help you stay on track. So look what it says. You start off with evaluation of last week's homework. Why do you start with homework? Because that's what you gave them last week to extend the counseling session. It extended what you talked about. So the homework you gave them was, let's say, as an example, you're dealing with somebody that they just have a really hard time using appropriate language. So they've been coming to you for discipleship. How do I change my tongue? So you've addressed the fact that God requires us to be good witnesses to those around us. So if somebody's cussing and then they're trying to witness an hour later at the lunchroom, it's just not going to go over well, right? You're not representing God correctly, okay? Let's say we went over it. So we went over verses that talked about whatever is good, whatever is righteous, think on these things. And then we took them to a verse where it talked about use language that elevates, doesn't bring people down. So cursing brings people down. It's nasty. It has a bad tone to it. Whereas good stuff is uplifting. It's edifying. So God says, let our speech be edifying. Right? So that's where I would put in the Bible memory there. Then the devotions, what I have him do. And then this week's homework, I'll do that at the end. But then it says session notes. That's what I'm going to write when I'm talking to the person about where we're at. And the hard thing always doing counseling guides in this class is you don't really have anybody sitting in front of you talking. So you're kind of making the whole thing up. Or you can pray that God will put somebody in your situation right now that's will accordingly match up with your homework, you know? So you need to bring somebody that has some type of small addiction and you can work with them on it, or just make it up. So, and then propose topics for this session. You would have done that ahead of time. So in this one, I would have maybe I would have given an example of what happens when you are watching the news and you see a political person who's in charge, a senator or a House of Representatives members in Washington, and they blurt out and are caught on tape using cursory language. What is your opinion? What happens? And the person says, wow, I lose a lot of respect to them. Why is that? You respected them before they cussed. Why not? Well, because, guy, put them down on my level. So it wasn't good, was it? Was God honored in that? No. Look at Romans 13. We are to honor those people who are set above us, because God raises up kings and brings kings down. Are they good representatives of God? No. There you go. That's why we don't do it. So, you know, all the way down. And then levels of problems. Notice what it says right away. Feeling, doing, heart. Because the problem is either going to be a feeling problem. Well, I didn't feel like it. I didn't believe it. You know, oh, woe is me. It's a doing problem. They didn't do what you asked them to do. Or it's a heart problem. They've yet to confess it as sin. Okay? And then problems to address in the future. Pretty self-explanatory. Make sense? And then the last sheet. Biblical summary and planning. So then they just go over all those questions and answer all those so that you feel good about doing the next session. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So you see how extensive biblical counseling can be. It takes an hour and a half to prepare for a 30-minute session. You just don't go in and wing it. So does that make sense? So I'll do more on addictions every week as we go. I'll keep bringing a little more in, but basically I can't do much more than I did last semester, except make it more specific this semester about, so we'll have, you know, U-Turn for Christ will be on tape next time. We'll talk about alcoholism, and I'll have some handouts on drug addiction. The biggest thing you'll face in church today, right now, in the arena we are, here at Maranatha Chapel or at Santee or at Horizon, is you'll have guys that are Christians that have a relationship with Jesus Christ. They're coming to church on a regular basis, and they're drinking like sieves on the weekends at football games. They just, it's like, how do you balance this out? So some will eventually come for help in men's group and stuff. You can have ladies who aren't going to football games, but in the, you know, the kids are driving them nuts. As soon as the kids go to school, they're dipping in the wine sauce. You know, the what's the Maraschino, what's that one wine that they put it on? The cream de menthe. I mean, whatever, you know, they're having a glass of wine, and it's always with that phrase, I just need to have a little downtime. I need to mellow out. So what have they done? They've replaced what God can do in their life through prayer and worship, because God will do the same thing. God's endorphins are better than alcohol endorphins. They'll do that. The other thing you'll see in churches today is a tremendous problem with prescription drugs. And so we have people who are addicted to painkillers. We have people that are addicted to calming drugs that we talked about 2 weeks ago, Prozac, things like that, things that mellow them out. And they've replaced the power of God in their lives with the power of a chemical. Now, I'm going to say it again so it's on the tape. There are people that need to have medical attention. But like Ed Welch says in his book, Blame It on the Brain, same guy that wrote Banquets for the Grave, we treat the physical medically on this end, and we treat the spiritual on this end. The symptoms can be the same. Look at the symptoms, treat it physically with a medical profession, and then we treat it biblically over here. Those two things together make a person whole. So we're not going to do one or the other. We're not going to go, well, you don't need, get off your Prozac. Come to my Bible study instead. And then the person goes wacko and commits suicide. You don't want to be there for that. Let the doctor decide all that. So that's that. Does that make sense? Okay. When it comes to dealing with a specific counseling problem, then at the end of the class, I'll give you the whole bibliography of the class, but I'll show you where to get in touch with all these different groups and stuff. So it's like you can go to this company, Faith, where I got my videotapes from the last class. This is from Lafayette, same place. These are the Faith. They have 80 or 90 of these little booklets. You name the symptom or the thing going through, and there's a book on how to counsel somebody through that. It can, you name it. It's like how to deal with an abused child, how to be the parent of an abused child. You know, all those things. It's just the counseling guides are out there, and they're already pre-written for you. You just have to walk the person through using the format that I just gave you. And then I'm going to add to that format, because the BCF organization that does the self-confrontation class, which is two thick books about like that, all have covered 80% of that in the last two classes. So you'll actually have it. So I'll be adding handouts to that. Okay? Good on that? All right, let's take a quick break, and then we'll do abortion.
So
remind me, and I'll send this to you on to your email.
Okay.
Then you'll have it. The class.
Oh, class. Oh, I'm just 10 minutes early. Is there, am I going to miss a lot?
You're leaving 10 minutes early?
Yeah.
No, I'm going to do my quickest to get out of here. You're going to miss part of that.
Oh, for that.
So that, just send me an email.
Okay.
And remind me because I'll forget, and I'll send you a copy of this on the email.
Okay.
I'll just forward it to you. Okay. We're back on tape, are we not? Yes, we are. Good, perfect. Okay, we're moving into abortion. One of the biggest things facing the church outside of pornography and same-sex marriage and homosexuality now is the subject of abortion. And so many people are suffering and recovering from it. So let me just talk about it, and then I'm going to have you guys watch it. We kill all adverse pregnancies. In other words, you do a test, you find out that the baby has some disease or some deformity, and so right away the doctors in the hospital are advising you abort the baby.
Mm-hmm.
What does that do to a society? That, are we going to have a society of only perfect people then? Are we going to lose our empathy for those that are less fortunate? What happens to the society? There's nothing more beautiful than a Down syndrome child and how loving and pure they are. I just, you know, it's like, we talked about it in our class, but it's almost like, I love what they said when they were just trying to confirm the new Secretary of Education, and the progressive left was saying, we can't have her because she doesn't take care of handicapped children. And then they would leave and go to the next room where they were going to support Planned Parenthood and abort any and all babies that have a learning disability. So it's like, which way do you want it? So it's kind of crazy. So the other thing, when you kill a baby before it's born, you have no way to know if that was a hero or a heroine that you've killed. I mean, that could have been the person that solved the next future survival, figured out a way to cure cancer, you know? You know, we would never have Abraham Lincoln if Abraham Lincoln's mom had aborted the baby. Yeah.
I am the hemophilia carrier.
Right.
So my daughter is a hemophilia carrier.
Right.
So when she got pregnant, the first of all, we wish it could be a girl. Girl would be okay.
Yeah.
Maybe half a carrier or half a normal.
Right.
So the 12 weeks later, we know it's boy. So we pray, we cry a lot. So the genetic counselor pushing her.
To have an abortion.
Because
yeah.
The genetic counselor is 50-50 chances very high.
Right.
So the 28 weeks in pregnancy, and we figured out he's the baby is a hemophilia or normal. So it's too late to abort. So we told them, oh, no matter what, we'll keep him. So there's the, oh, you will regret, and it will be too late. It's, now this is the boy, and 50-50 chance, please. There is a counselor.
I know.
So God is good. He's now 19 months. He's normal. So thank God. But no matter what, he is a hemophilia, so we keep him. But you know, the medical, the genetic counselor, yeah, that's their, what is it, policy.
That's their job.
Yeah, that's their business. So sad. So I report, but no one cares.
I know where the world thinks,
mm-hmm.
but they're not in charge. So
the
other thing is, you know, the other thing that cracks me up is it means you kill all future taxpayers. Right? Aren't you really doing that? Take the black population, the African American population. It's 12% of America. The founder of Planned Parenthood believed in erasing the black population. She's the founder of Planned Parenthood. She wanted to erase a whole race of people. More, there are more black abortions than there are white abortions. And
yeah.
So, if you want a voting block, look at the Hispanics. They're 30-something percent of America now. They have a huge voting block. Look at blacks. They're still 11%. Yeah. So it's crazy. And then, if you'll notice in abortion, you'll never hear it on TV or advertisements. They never use the word kill. They never use the word destroy. They never use the word rip apart. For them, it's very clean. We're going to have an abortion. But anybody who's seen the picture of an abortion, watched it happen, it literally tears the fetus apart. Okay? A woman's cycle is every 28 days. When one gets pregnant, that baby has a heartbeat at 21 days. So that's why you have problems with fetal alcohol syndrome, because people are still drinking after the first period has been missed because they don't even know they're pregnant. It's just, it's insane, okay? I love the oxymoron of the name Planned Parenthood, because once you abort the baby, there's no parenthood to be done. Get it? Planned Parenthood. Oxymoron. There is no parenthood. Okay? There is no rearing of a child. Okay? Satan's goal in having abortions, okay, was that he figured, I know how I can keep millions of little babies out of heaven. Will abort them before they can accept Jesus Christ as their Savior. He forgot one thing. What did David say when his son from Bathsheba was taken from him? Okay? My son cannot come to me, but I can go to my son. In other words, every aborted baby is in heaven.
Heaven?
Yeah, they're in heaven. Yep. So that means you know, Satan just lost out on the population explosion in heaven. Okay? Basically, 18 to 24 years old are most abortions. Abby Johnson, who is heads up, you can go online and go to Abby Johnson, I think it's .com. She's the former head. She never saw an abortion while she was head of Planned Parenthood until one day she actually saw what happened, and then she could never do it, or never be that again, so she left. So, good place to go. Then they always talk about rape victims. Well, the way God designed the human body, the majority of rape victims are so traumatic that the union of the two cells never happens anyway. The body discharges it. It doesn't happen. It's only 1/3 of 1%. 1/3 of 1%. So when the politicians throw out all these things, I kind of like look at them like they've lost their mind. So what is, in 1973, we'd already had 35 million abortions in America.
In 1 year?
No, in 1973, that's how many we've had for 25 years. But how many do we have today now? We'd have to like quadruple that number. It's horrible. Okay, the bottom line is, what does the Bible say about it? It's taking of the human life. Why do they not call it anything but abortion? Because again, just like in psychology, they do not believe we're created beings, so that thing that is being aborted isn't a human being, it's just a mass of tissue. But again, in 21 days, it has a heartbeat. So.
Even before that 21 days, before heartbeat, just the first day, that's the already became life, isn't it?
Well, I'll answer your question this way. I hate to admit this, but the Catholics are right. the minute there's a union between a sperm and an egg, life has begun. As soon as it divides once, it's been imputed with the Spirit of God. So it's a living thing. Now, in 21 days, it actually has a heartbeat. So, you know, at 10 days, it's a mass of cells still. But it still has a spirit in it. Because Jeremiah said, God told Jeremiah, before I formed you in my mother's womb, I knew you. Then Psalms talks about it also. You are fearfully and wonderfully made. So God is real clear that he is a part of creation. And he didn't change. God is immutable. He does not change. So the very mere fact of how he created life, Adam and Eve are the only two that, Adam came without a woman. Eve came without a woman. They're the only two. After that, it was the union of a man and a woman producing a baby. The only other one, of course, is who? Jesus Christ. Okay. The Holy Spirit was the man in this case. But otherwise, you only have three cases. Okay. The big question to beg is, did Adam have a belly button? That's going to be the question I get to heaven. When I get to heaven, that's what I want to look at. Hey, Adam, come here. Lift up your shirt. Just want to see. Eve, let me check it out. That's what I'm going to ask. I have these serious questions to ask, you know?
Adam's going to be right here.
Yeah, Adam's going to have that big scar here from her rib, you know? So, okay, anyway. Man is uniquely created in God's image, Genesis 1:27. Okay? And listen, in Exodus 20:13, he made it clear. Exodus 20:13. Whoever sheds man's blood, by his blood it will be shed, for he is in the image of God, man made him. God made man. So it's like, no, you don't go around killing. It's period. So for the Christian, it's what we just don't go by it. So let me show you this video. This is my class on Thursday night. Comes up. Let's try it again. What happened here? We won't finish this whole thing tonight. So.
Treated and warped into a sense of security with the very people who are trying to hurt you and keep you captive. And so all that is reality. Okay. Same thing was true when I talked about schizophrenia. There's no doubt in my mind that schizophrenia exists. My only difference in treating it biblically is that I'll address what the medical doctors, the medical profession, treat the physical symptoms, and I'll then treat it biblically on the other end because it's a spiritual battle. Okay? And I talked about after class, and I think we'll bring it up after addictions next week. If you'll remind me, we talked about what about people that have dual and tri personalities where they have three people living inside them. So I went and did some homework on it, because whenever you guys ask me questions, it causes me to go to work. But I felt really comfortable with my answer to you in that although they will exhibit this dual, triple, Sybil is the one everybody comes to, you know, with the, I think it was 12 personalities or something like that. The Bible tells us that we only have one spirit, and God dwells in one spirit. So then the question begs, where are those other things from? We'll cover that more when we get into demonic possession and demon oppression. We get our panel of pastors talking about that, because I think it's better answered there. I think it's a combination of physical, I think it's a combination of mental, I think it's a combination of spiritual. So that would be, if you weren't after class last time, you know. The other thing is, we missed Sonic tonight because I'm an idiot. So if you didn't, how many people went over to Sonic?
Yeah. I forgot.
I was there. Okay. All right. I know. Tell you what I'm going to do. If it's okay with you, if I don't have anything going tonight, I'm not going to L.A., can we just go right after class? I mean, I'll even throw in a hot dog or a hamburger to make up for my sin. You know, I'll bribe you. You know, so we'll have something sweet and good for us, and something bad for us. And combination will offset the other. So, you know. Or you guys can go have a meal at the stand in line at the carbohydrate overkill. So anyway, so we'll do that afterwards if you guys want to do that. Okay? All right? All right, still waiting for Lisa. So okay, task personalities. Do you remember the last one I left off with? Because I didn't mark it.
I think you've already done this.
Personalities, I'm talking about shy, so I think.
The two classes are covering all the same stuff, but they're a week behind you, and then sometimes they're
talking about the anxious to cooperate person. Did I undo that? Problem. We'll do it right now. Then here we go. Ready? All right. People who are anxious to cooperate. Okay, you got to watch out, because such persons may at the onset seem anxious to cooperate until something arises of which they disapprove. Okay? So they're anxious to, when your counselee is ready for help, then give it to him. What you should strive for is rapport between him and God. So the people that are over anxious to cooperate, usually it's because it's a defense mechanism not to have to deal with what you're going to end up talking about. So they seem overly cooperative, okay? And you will run into those kind of people, okay? So that's one, anxious to cooperate. Then people who are shy, and you have to guard against your opinion of the person you're dealing with, because some people truly are shy, and you're going to have to really pull from them after your PDI and the information. You're going to have to pull from them because they just are not willing to give a lot of information. But that also has to be guarded against, because some people who are really shy, and that's their personality. My wife is shy. She really does not like to come and talk to classes. When she comes and talks to you guys about pornography and stuff, that's not something she likes to do. The fact that there's only 10 of you is really making her feel good, you know, because she'll sit over there and not be up here, so she'll go right there. But her shyness is real, and so it's not something negative. Okay. The other part about being shy is you got to watch out, because the shyness can be not real. It can be a defense mechanism, again, not to get out into the real mix of the conversation. Okay, if I'm quiet, if I don't respond, then I don't have to respond. Okay? All right? They also have a great fear of failing. Shy people tend to have a great fear of failing. Okay? And that can be a learned behavior or a synthetic experience. So watch out for that, okay? Remember that God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble, 1 Peter 5:5. So you want to share that. That being humble is okay if that's part of the shyness. Okay? But when we're in counseling, there has to be an open rapport between the counselee and God, and obviously that has to be an open rapport between you and the counselee. You want to open it up and get those pathways of conversation going. Because again, let's go back 2 weeks. You're going to have empathy for whatever problem your person is going through. So you're going to identify it and say, you know, I would feel badly about that situation too. That's a real feeling you have. We don't ever discount the feeling. We just say, we're not going to listen to the feeling. We're going to do what God tells us to do. Okay? So we want to calculate acts that will help the person grow. So the homework for a shy person is intended to get them out of that. Okay? All right? Then you have the interested but uncertain people. Interested but uncertain. They come for help, but they have a whole list of reservations in their hip pocket. And they're the ones that tend to have lots of excuse language. Now, in your book, it talks about language. Remember that? You guys got to that chapter?
You guys said language.
And it talks about language. And in the back of your book,
in the back of the book,
your manual,
it gives you 15
things that people can use
as excuses,
basically.
Well, I
fixed
that.
And it's what the person says. We went over last week, we talked about, well, that's just the way I am. That's the biggest one. Yeah. Well, my dad had this temper, so I have this temper. Well, I've learned that, remember when I showed you the John Wayne saying in the last class? I won't be wronged. I won't be spoken ill of. I don't do these things to other people. And I expect them not to do them to me. Basically, I'm going to punch them out, right? Well, that's not what Jesus said. He said, meek, be forgiving. So they're interested, but uncertain. And they have never learned this truth. Those people have never learned that the Lord Jesus Christ is the good shepherd. And so you're going to have to teach that. So through Psalms, you're going to teach about the fact that, listen, David left all the sheep to save the one. That's the same thing Jesus did. If you were the only person on earth, he would have put on the cross for you. So, also, some people that are interested but uncertain may distrust your qualifications. So don't take offense if they suddenly throw up to you, well, what makes you think you're the guru of counseling? You can be very honest and use that line I always use. I'll tell them my story, so they'll tell me theirs. I can tell them, this is what I'm trained in. This is the extent of what I know. The only thing I'm trying to tell you is the Bible has these things to say about how to be well, and I'm going to do it that way so that I can say to you, thus saith the Lord. Okay? So don't be taken aback if they question your authority. I mean, I've had people question mine, and it's like, you know, my first reaction is like, who are you asking me? What? Who are you talking to? You know, like the taxi driver, like, you're talking to me? You can't do that. That's going to be your defense mechanism coming up, okay? Because you go into every counseling situation, you go in with your own fusus too. You go in with your own prejudice.
I went over fusus.
You know, that's why prayer is so important. You got to leave self at the door. And you're going in, you're going to take a time out of your season to invest in their season. And so you leave your feelings at the door. But be honest with them. You know, if they ask you, well, I started the class today. When you asked me the question last class, I told you, I said, I'm not really sure of all those answers about people that have multiple personalities. I said, but I'll investigate it. But my gut level reaction right off the top as a biblical counselor was, that flies in the face of biblical truth, because the Bible says we only have ourself. You know, Judas was what? Occupied by a spirit. Satan was able to come upon him and in him. Okay, so that's where that personality came from, to do the things he did. But there's not, you know, if there's a multiple, I'm not saying people don't have a multiple personality, because they very well can. We've got evidence that people have that, but I would say a lot of that is spiritual. So, here's the one that kills me, as I put a little check mark in my little book. Sooner or later, you're going to run into the counselor who is your counselee, and they are the counselor. And before you know it, they turn the counseling session into them being the counselor and having all the answers, and you're just going to have to nip that in the bud. You just have to. Okay? They're there for a reason. They came to you for a reason. Okay? And be open about it and just say, hey, thank you for that advice, but we're going to stick to this issue today. That's where you're going to be really good about note-taking, and I'll go over the papers that I handed out today, and you'll see where that will help. Okay? All right? When counseling a counselor, if you get one that's actually a counselor, okay, like if I was counseling Lisa, who's going to be here tonight, she's a counselor. So I would be wise to speak clearly at the outset, not only about the possible differences in the counseling methodologies that I might use, but also
it's
about the
issues
that I
watched myself,
you know,
teaching.
Would make come up.
I'm kind of going,
the more clarity about
dang.
Your relationship roles in counseling that you can achieve, the better counseling will progress.
Yeah,
so absolute transparency should characterize all that you say and do. Absolute transparency.
I feel like I'm an Italian. My hands are always moving.
Yeah. You are doing great.
You'll never find this next group, the lazy and indifferent. Yes, unless, and thank you for saying that, because a lot of people that are going to come in your way after they get to know that you are in your church, when you go back home and you're starting to help certain people and you get a reputation for being able to counsel someone, the church is going to take advantage of that, trust me. And then you're going to get people that will say, hey, you need to go see so-and-so because they can help you with this. And so you're going to get the person that's been shoved in the door to come see you. Lazy and indifferent, though, are sins. Lazy and indifferent are sins. Now, you may detect laziness and indifference in your counselee. There's two ways. Here's how you figure it out. Through the counselee's attitudes are number one. And I mean the frame of mind that they exhibit towards certain persons and circumstances. Okay? So let me give you an example. The couple that I was counseling back east, the man in this situation is incredibly lazy about doing anything that the counseling sessions have asked him to work on. So he's become a scholar in knowing the biblical truths and can verbatim tell you what the Bible says, but he fails to ever do them. He can quote exactly what he's supposed to do as a husband, and then he doesn't get around to ever doing it. That's just completely lazy. Okay? He's just not doing it. Okay? The second thing is through their homework assignments. You can pick up lazy and indifference through that. So that's the two things, okay? And a foolish person's attitude is one of a foolish mind. And you read in Proverbs that fools are ready. Just do a word search on fools in Proverbs, and you will get verse after verse about what it says about what foolish decisions people make. Okay? For instance, Proverbs 6:6-11. Proverbs 10:4. And verse 26. Chapter 19:15. Chapter 22:13. Chapter 24:30-34. These passages, not only does God mock, literally mock, the person that is lazy, but also shows the dire consequences of...
Let's take a 5-minute break. So, Lord, we'll just take a quick break here, and that's it.
Thank you.
Okay, this is Lisa coming now on abortion, so let me get this right. I made a mistake there. I thought she was working in an office she was the year before, which was secular. She's in a totally Christian environment now.
Officially representing the school district and the state, and then when the door was closed and it was just me and the counselee, I would then talk to them if they were open to it, things that were biblical. So I was taking the proverbial chance. So, covered by the grace of God. So, her presentation is awesome, and so I'm just going to get out of her way and let it rip, and then I'll talk about the philosophy behind abortion from a biblical perspective at what she's done, and how that, and she's going to touch on most of those things, and I'll reinforce some of it from a technical standpoint. With that, I'm getting out of the way.
All right. Hi, guys. As he said, my name is Lisa. This is Nancy. She's the RN in the facility, and I'm a post-abortion facilitator, and I'm also a crisis counselor, which means that when young women or men also as well come in and the couple's pregnant, I'm the one that they first get to greet. And if they're post-abortive, which means they've already had an abortion and they're struggling, they come in to seek help for healing and restoration, and I'm the one that gets to walk them through that. It's a nine-week Bible study we walk through. And so I am not a professional speaker, so I want to get that right out of the way. That's not what I do. I'm just a counselor. So I am what 2 Corinthians 3-4. Do you guys know? Yeah? Can somebody read that out loud? Or can somebody? Anybody? Do you know it by heart? Right. So, because God walks through, comforts us as we go through the ugly, and then we turn around and we, in return, comfort those who are going through it. So, with that said, if you guys have any questions after we speak, I'm more than happy to answer, as well as Nurse Nancy here. I have had an abortion myself, so when I'm talking to you, it's not from something that I'm just getting because I'm hearing it, but because I've walked through it, and now I am counseling women, a lot of young women, older women as well, as they come through. So what a crisis counselor does is basically in our facility they come in and they are normally astounded because they're pregnant, and of course they're pregnant because they've had sex. And so what I get to tell them is that's not the worst of it, because you can survive pregnancy. What you can't survive is STDs. And no one thinks STDs, because what STDs does is it either causes you to no longer be able to, you can become infertile, no more babies for you in the future when you have a husband or a wife as well, and it can actually, you can die from STDs, but people don't realize that. And society today has taught us through rap music, through commercials, everything's sex, 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 and that's not what God created sex for. So I explained to them that sex is a beautiful thing that God created that you're supposed to share between a husband and a wife so that you can express love towards each other and create a family, not for us to be laying around with every Joe and every Betty Sue that's out there, because that's where we end up picking up STDs. So after that conversation goes, continues on, basically, we give them a pregnancy test, and if that pregnancy comes back positive, depending on the individual, they either have a massive meltdown right there on the spot, and a lot of them normally want to abort. And so my next question is, why? Why are we aborting? Like, what's the cause? Like, what are your thoughts? And they express that the reason behind it is because it has to do with their careers or their education. And my response is that you can always go back for your career, and you can go back for your education, but you can never go back for a dead baby. In fact, they believe that once we have, or they have an abortion, that you're no longer a parent. And the fact of the matter is that it's not that you are you're not a parent, you're just a parent of a dead baby. And no one thinks of that. And in return, they don't realize that normally the man doesn't get a say. He never gets a say so normally, and when he does, he gets dismissed, which is a bad situation because they're just taking away their manhood by not allowing them to say what they no input. So they get damaged as well. The abortion affects everyone. It affects the grandparents still get to be grandparents. Siblings still get to be aunts and uncles. It just trickles down. And not only that, but we know that God says that for every person that he's created, he's got a plan for them, right? So how do we know that that one baby that's being aborted is not the next baby that's going to, I don't know, kill cancer? We don't know, but we just eliminated that baby. So I try to explain that to them, and I also try to explain to them what abortion looks like. So 5 years from now, where are you going to be? Where are you going to be? Like, can you actually sit in the table realizing, you know, and coming to the conclusion of the real realization that there is no baby? There's a missing family member there. So your firstborn, that you eliminated, then comes the second born, and that's when all the emotions come back. And they begin to think, these females start to think, you know, when these women go and get an abortion, they never come out with a badge. They speak abortion and all the abortion thing, but do you guys ever get an opportunity to hear them speak after they had an abortion? They don't come out with a badge. They're not proud of it. Oh, yeah, I had an abortion. They don't speak of it. It's very silent, and it's very hush-hush. Nobody wants to discuss that. So we are the ones that pick up the broken pieces when they come to us shattered. And it does happen. It either happens within that week, within that month, and sometimes, in my case, not till 20 years later. Because the industry, what they do is they lie to us. They tell us it's just a piece of tissue, and there is no baby, and we need to go after our careers, and we need to go after our education. So what happens with that is, at the end of the day, when the woman gets pressured either by, usually it can be that, or they also, because their parents don't want them to have a baby, or their boyfriend wants them to eliminate or terminate the pregnancy, and so the female gets pressured into it, and then later she comes back and she goes through serious just remorse. And it's no different. It's a loss is what's happening. It's a complete loss. And when they come to the realization of what abortion actually is, which is really you're killing your baby. But they don't let you believe that that's what it is, but that's exactly what it is. After we get to sit with them and explain to them exactly what abortion is, what it looks like, and that they can always go back, but you can never go back for this baby that's a dead baby, we move them into the ultrasound room, and that's when Nurse Nathan comes in and she takes over, and usually they will see a heartbeat, and they'll see the baby's already there. It's unbelievable, because you think at the, what, like that, heartbeat starts in 21 days, correct? 21 days, a heartbeat begins. Okay, so by the time you ladies find out we're pregnant, because, you know, how often is your cycle every, what, 28? Right? Usually 28 days. So by the time you find out you're pregnant, there's already a heartbeat. But they tell us that there's no baby there. There's no baby, but in fact there is, because it's life. And life begins once the egg meets that sperm and there becomes conception. And in that conception is the baby's DNA is already there, the baby's color of eyes, the baby's personality, the baby's hair, if it's curly, brown, blue eyes, green eyes, it's already there. It's just a matter of time to allow that egg or that baby to begin to grow. That's all it is. But we've been taught to believe that it's nothing. It's just a little flesh. Not even a flesh, it's just a piece of tissue. It's just tissue. So that's a lie. What happens after that, when they first come in, we let them know that we're not going to judge them. Whatever your choices are, we're going to support you. If you choose to move forward with an abortion, we also do a post-abortion recovery, and that we offer a Bible study to walk them through. We're not there to judge. We're there to guide them and lead them. As a matter of fact, I'm that person that I wish I would have had speaking life into me and letting me know, look, this is what your future holds. And whatever you choose to do with that, just know that you're making an educated choice. You're not making a choice based on emotions. Because most of our females that do get abortions is because they're emotionally it's an emotional decision right on the spot. And if you guys know any better, if mom or dad have told you, or any mentor, that never make a decision based on an emotion. That's the worst decision. You'll regret it. So,
I made a horrible mistake as a counselor. I didn't preface your coming in case anybody here is suffering any of these things for your family.
I'm coming along, yeah. No worries. I was coming up at the end, but So when you go to a doctor's, usually, now it's Planned Parenthood, and isn't that deceiving, just the name of it alone? You go to the doctors, and basically, they tell you it's no big deal, as I said before. You know, you need to follow your career and get your education. You don't have time for a baby right now. You can do this later. What they don't tell you is the after effects of the symptoms of abortion, which usually is anxiety, depression, guilt, shame, self-destructive behaviors such as eating disorders, substance abuse, and you also get psychological, emotional symptoms, which is a lot of the reasons why a lot of our females, and males too, you'd be surprised how many males get affected by it, that they just get short, they're short-tempered, they're just short-fused, they're angry, they're bitter, and then, you know, it's like, well, what's your problem? Well, because they're dealing with certain situations, such as an abortion, and people don't talk about it, so they don't even get help because it is a shameful subject, and not everyone's willing to talk about it. So women carry that with them all of their lives until they finally have a meltdown, and they all go through it. There will come a time where everyone that has an abortion will have to face the reality of the choices that they made, and by that time, usually they're married, and they realize that their kid has been robbed of a sibling, and they've been robbed of a child, and they robbed their parents of a grandkid, and there's a missing member in the family. Also, what they don't tell you, and we've been saying this for many years, is that Planned Parenthood, they sell baby body parts. And when we used to say that or share the truth with people, they didn't believe us. Until now, all of a sudden, the Lord brought what was hidden in the darkness into the light, and that's a fact, and that's been happening for years. And it's an evil, it's just an evil kind of business that's going on out there. If you know anyone that has suffered from abortion or is planning on having abortion or is just struggling in any way, we are here to help them. 100%. Like, we will help. We're not here to judge, as I said before. We're here to allow God to come alongside of us and walk alongside of them and be that support system. Because
there are San Diego places.
It's no different
like this
than having a niece, a nephew, a brother, a sister, and they're 3 years old and you're getting in a car wreck, and then all of a sudden that baby's dead. By the time they realize it, that's the impact of how strong it hits women that have walk through abortion. But they're going so fast in life because they want to do their careers and they want to get their education that they don't have time to think about it. When everything calms down, it starts to creep up. And it's a nagging, nudging just thought that's always going to be there, especially when you have more kids. And there's a lot more symptoms that come along with abortion as far as when you become a parent, you either overparent or you underparent because you feel guilty because, you know, you suffered a loss from your first baby that nobody knows. Usually you keep it within yourself. With that said, we prepared some packages there, and it has information for STDs, the kind of STDs
that
would
affect
you.
And I'll pick up these packages for you.
And
depending
on how many people you have,
she's gonna come tonight.
You have had sexual intercourse with. You know, you think you have sexual intercourse with one person, but that's not how it goes, because whoever that person's been with, it just goes on and on. Please. This is one of my favorite ones. I love to pull this out every time a kid comes in, because it's a visual, and most of us weren't a visual, and I don't think you guys are too far, but for every one to sexual partner, we have, these are your sexual exposures. Oops, sorry, Gary. Can you see that? Kind of scary, huh? So it puts things in perspective. So I've prepared a little package for you guys. Oh no, I'll let them grab them. Well, you can if you'd like. But do you guys want to pass them out? You guys just grab the box and let them grab it. So basically, it's a package that shows you the size of a child, the size of a child's feet when it's little feet when it's 10 weeks old, because you know it's just it's a baby. It's not a tissue. Yes, and please remember that you will, if you do not already, have friends, family members, peers that They've walked through it. They've walked through it, or they're currently struggling at this moment with that very problem. And now you guys have the ability to help them out. If you just pull out a pamphlet and tell them, hey, man, you know, here's where it's at, and there's a number, and they can help you if you like. If you guys have any questions. No? Okay, so I'm going to let her share the medical side of it, because she gets the fun part. She gets to bring them in and see the heartbeats and show them the real deal, like there's a real baby there. So
what I like about the presentation is the contrast between what they're told in the secular world and then what they're told biblically about the reality. For instance, when you have an abortion, it literally rips out that part of the uterus. It leaves a big hole in the uterus. Whereas a miscarriage, the body automatically redoes itself and the uterus remains intact. So it's damaging to a woman. They don't tell them that.
Interesting fact is that in California, you don't have to record abortions to the CDC. So that numbers you get are just estimates. And we know stats, you can have stats, but statisticians can lie. So you never quite know, but we can make pretty good comparisons to other metro areas like this. So we just heard Planned Parenthood has done about 350,000 abortions this year. But combined with all the other facilities that also do abortions, it's probably close to $750 million abortions a year. That's big money. And I know they say that it's only, I think the going thing is it's 3% of their services. I think that's the latest. And the way they do that is they count every single. If you go in and get your blood pressure checked, that's one visit. You go back, get a pregnancy test, that's two visits. You go back, have your abortion, that's three visits. Go back for a checkup, another visit. Go back for your birth control, another visit. Go back for STD, say 5-6 visits. In that whole picture, then, they say, well, look, the abortion was only a small percentage of all those visits. But really, that's where most of the money comes from. So it's... So 750,000 abortions, and even though we know 25% of all clinically recognized pregnancies will end in miscarriage, you can't stop one, you can't start one, but we know it happens, and we know that when you go in to Planned Parenthood or family planning, they will charge you for an abortion even if you're miscarrying, and we know that 25% of clinically recognized pregnancies are miscarriages, or blinded ovums. We see it because we do ultrasound, so I know that, and I hate to think, and that's kind of why one of the reasons we say we want to do an ultrasound is to see if there's a miscarriage happening, so they wouldn't go through a trauma, that unnecessary trauma, and also because it could also be in the wrong place. So we care about their health, their well-being. We care what happens in the big picture. We have no financial interest in their reproductive choices at all. We make no money. We're a licensed free clinic. Mostly, there's a few of us that are paid, where's Lisa? Mostly volunteers. So we have no financial interest. I mean, if they, unlike if you went to Planned Parenthood, would you really get an unbiased view of what your choices are? They make too much money for you to have that. So anyway, there are always casualties and insults to the body in an abortion. I mean, there's always a chance of an infection because if you already have an STD, it's going to now become septic possibly, and we've heard of that, or else you could puncture the uterus and that goes your chances for more pregnancies possibly. There's a really good image, and it's you would see it, but if you can imagine, especially when we had winds a few weeks ago and we saw trees uprooted, if you can imagine, say this, okay, here's a uterus, and the placenta's up here. Now, if you can imagine how a big tree gets pulled up, from the tree. That's what an abortion does to a uterus. It pulls out, right? Leaves a hole. You can never implant in that area again. That's it. There's just so many optimum areas where you can have a really good implantation. So you want to preserve that. This is a gift. Women have an immense gift. And if I can just convey that to these girls, that God has given you such a gift, please treasure and take care of it. And as she was talking about STD. Mm-hmm. Farther along? Or not?
No, no. If they had the actual abortion, then we know what result the study shows. But what if it's a miscarriage? Did that?
Oh, that's so different. I'm so glad you asked that. So in a miscarriage, and this is something else we see on the ultrasound, you can have a positive pregnancy test and actually have miscarry because your body will back out of that pregnancy very slowly, which is good. That's good for women because you've got breasts going through, the cells in the breast going through massive changes, and it has a very orderly yes, and so you back out of that in the way that God intended to. It could take 6 weeks, and you've already miscarried, and now you go in and you get an ultrasound, and they see the baby doesn't have a heartbeat, and we can tell when they miscarried. So maybe they should have been 12 weeks, but the baby's measuring 6 weeks. That's when the miscarriage actually occurred, when the heart stopped beating, and we don't know why God does so. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, it's good for every part of your body to have that. Well, God's a God of order, and to have that ability, or that He gave our body that ability to back out, it leads to less breast cancer. Makes sense, right? If you have not allowed those developing mammary glands and the cells in the breast to turn off in the way they were meant to turn off, it's much better for the woman. So, let's see. I don't know where you're all at as far as your base level.
We'll pick this up at the beginning of class.
Abortion or any kind of
we'll do the
frame of
nature
reference,
for Christ.
Just what you've heard or friends, or how about the abortion pill? Are you 46? Any questions about that?
That's the big thing too about the R46 pill, because it's a chemical way to have an abortion. You're still killing the cells that are alive. And that's what I said in class, what the Catholics are right. Catholics are the ones that said inception is when life starts. And Protestants have been slow to the table. So they had it right.
Said what?
At inception, mm-hmm. when a sperm and an egg unite, mm-hmm. that's when life exists.
At the first stage, right?
The first stage.
The Catholics said? Mm-hmm.
They've always said that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Protestants, we've been slow to the table. We think it what happened. You know, God sent His Spirit at the 18th week, when it actually became. It's not true. It's once it has a heartbeat, mm-hmm. 21 days. Well, we know that God has said, "Before I formed you, I knew you." Mm-hmm. So that means God literally is indwelling in that spirit of that child, mm-hmm. from the time that the inception occurs. But it's just a lot of stuff. But you'll see, I think abortion and post-abortion is probably one of the biggest things that churches face today, because you have women that aborted 25 years ago and they've never told anybody about it, and then they're going to retreats, and then they run into somebody, and then they just have a meltdown all of a sudden, and you wonder why. Well, because they've never really received their forgiveness, and they don't realize that God's a God of forgiveness, and you know, yeah, what you did was wrong. It's a sin. Admit it. Turn from it and go the other way. Now you can be used to help other people not make the same mistake. So then I'll bring these packets. They have a whole packet for you guys on counseling, on living together, why marriage, about STDs, the whole thing. So it gives you a whole panoramic view of what God views as good sex versus bad sex, and what the ramifications of having the bad sex are. It's schools don't teach this anymore. That's the sad part. You see how small the feet are? That's at 21 days. Mm-hmm. I mean,
just
so if I'm...
12 weeks?
Yeah, they're here. That's at 21 days.
10 weeks.
That's at... this is at 10 weeks. Yeah, 10 weeks.
I can't pull the glasses out. I can't.
Yeah, but I mean, I look at this and I go, okay, so if that's the feed, and there's the picture of it, if that's the feed at 21 days, then what, why are we talking about not being a living creature? It's a living creature. It's alive. Mm. We're going to suck it out with a vacuum?
They started with the brain first, the heart, and then the brain. So you
right.
see all this, you know, big, huge hat with, mm-hmm. With the very, very, like, slim hands and feet at the beginning.
Yeah.
And so when the feet is so complete, you see that other parts are pretty much, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, if the feet are, you can see, I'll never forget when I saw the ultrasound of little baby Ryan when she was 10 weeks old. She was in the womb, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she had her thumb up like this, like, I'm ready. You know, and we still have that picture. It's just like, how can anybody say that that's not true? So, on the little books that I hand out, you make sure you get all these back, okay? So your first counseling guide should have been on an addiction. We did it different than the syllabus only because I couldn't get the people to come at the right time. So now we're at number two, which is abortion. So, and don't worry about turning in a week late. It's okay.
Okay.
So
bring it back to you.
Yeah. Because I had to pay for all those, so I just
okay.
Yeah, they're hundreds of dollars. I either have them for all the classes coming after, so they're
okay.
not. Yeah,
I'll bring it next week.
Yeah, the college doesn't. You can. I'll tell you guys where to order these next week.
Okay.
I'll give you the online source. Okay. And then you can order wherever you want. They're like $2.95 a piece.
Okay.
Yeah, but all the books I have are what I buy for the class. Actually, I take all the money that I make from taking the class. I just invest in buying the stuff for the class because they don't give us anything. So. That's it. I'm done.
Thank you.